Hello, everybody. This is Chris with the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. And if you're like me, you're wondering what to do for Valentine's Day. It's right around the corner. Go to Sherry's Berries today. Happiness delivered. Sherry's Berries is an iconic brand that has been delighting customers with decadent, imaginative, gourmet food gifts for decades, featuring an irresistible assortment of treats dipped in indulgent toppings, including its famous farm fresh strawberries. Sherry's Berries is perfect for any occasion, but let's face it, the occasion that's coming up is Valentine's Day. You can choose from 12 different toppings. There's 9 million plus strawberries that are dipped annually. 30 gift varieties. What are you waiting for? Go to Sherry's Berries. It's berries.com. 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 Pick from a many innovative products. The talented artisans at Sherry's Berries craft deliciously different creations using only the freshest ingredients. Every juicy dipped berry is decorated with care using decadent toppings like ground toffee, drizzle, chocolate chips, and sprinkles. They are amazing. And when I buy them for my wife, she hardly gets to try them because I eat them all. That's how great they are. Go to berries.com today. You know, some people think that I tell my story to get praise or to, you know, be on the news or be on shows like this. And you don't realize how difficult it is to become so vulnerable and to open your family up to that scrutiny. But I know how important it is, because when a news segment airs, I get hundreds and sometimes thousands of comments and messages and people who are suffering in silence, and they tell me how much inspiration they get. And so I don't want my struggles and everything that I've suffered to be in vain. Like, I really believe that God gives people struggles and trials to overcome them and then to be that hope and help to other people.
And a Safford City Council member is suspending his campaign for Congress.
A Safford City Councilman has suspended his campaign for Congress after suffering a heroin overdose.
His name is Chris Taylor. You may actually know the name very well. It's been very publicized here in the Arizona media and the Arizona press.
Chris Taylor was running for the Republican nomination to challenge Democrat Tom O'Halloran this November.
And tonight, Chris Taylor says he is seeking treatment for substance abuse.
We first met Chris Taylor in 2017 as we dug in on the opioid problem plaguing the eastern Arizona city of Safford.
In a previous campaign ad, Taylor opened up about his struggles with opioid addiction after two tours in Afghanistan.
Taylor, a veteran who fought off addiction to open his own treatment center, was poised to be the success story for Safford. But he went backwards as old demons resurfaced last week. A relapse that resulted in an overdose. In a statement to suspend his congressional campaign, Taylor was very direct, saying, quote, "I'm not going to hide from this. I'm not ashamed of what happened. I wish to sincerely apologize to the amazing people who have supported me. It's a haunting reminder of a dark past that will always be looking over the shoulder of a bright future."
All right, everybody, welcome to a special edition of the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I'm your host, Chris Taylor, and if you haven't noticed yet, it is February. I believe today is February 6th, Saturday. By the time you hear this episode, it will probably be Monday or Tuesday, but I just like to know when the date is, because a lot of things I talk about are current events in the context of that day. But I don't know why I said that, because this episode has nothing to do with that. This episode has everything to do with history. Yes, history. And February, as many of you know, is Black History Month. I don't think we do enough 1 month out of the year to highlight some of the heroes of Black America, which is just America history. The people that I'm going to talk about today are people who I have always looked up to and idolized. Some of the stories that I will tell, I'll read a couple articles that I think capture the person that I want to talk about. Because I'm so involved in athletics, there is mostly athletes, and I think that just to get that out of the way, I think that does a disservice to the Black Americans, because you know they get this stereotype that you know to make it to be successful, you either have to be a professional athlete or a hip hop star, and that's I don't want to further that stereotype or that misconception, but for that reason, the people that I'm going to talk about, though they are the best athletes to ever play the sports that they played, but I'm going to focus on some of the things that they did off the court, off the field, and some of the things that they endured during the times that they played, and in the days, you know, when racism was so horrifically rampant and prevalent in our society. I believe that we have made major strides, but I also believe that ever so often we take steps backwards in the wrong direction, and we don't do enough for Americans of color. And you know, I don't like to say African Americans, because a lot of people that identify as Black don't have African roots. It's just, you know, so anyway, let's jump right into this. Who should I start with? I have a couple of people that I want to highlight here in this episode. Let's see. Let's start with John Lewis. John Lewis, of course, legendary civil rights activist, long standing member of the House of Representatives. He died recently, and I'm going to read a transcript of a PBS PBS documentary, I guess. I'm reading this for the first time. This is from Harry Srinivasan. John Lewis, one of the leaders of the civil rights movement and a member of Congress for more than 33 years, died yesterday of pancreatic cancer. He was 80 years old. Lewis was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer last December, but continued to work, to vote in the House of Representatives, and to speak out as Black Lives Matter movement and protests began this spring. In early June, Lewis, the newly named Black Lives Matter Plaza, he visited the newly named Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington, D.C. John Lewis. People in D.C. and around the nation are sending a mighty, powerful, and strong message to the rest of the world that we will get there. Back to Harry Srinivasan. In March, he traveled to the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama to attend the 55th anniversary of the voting rights protest and march there that became known as Bloody Sunday. In 1965, Lewis was severely injured on the bridge along with many others when the state police attacked the peaceful demonstrators. He was beaten and arrested dozens of times at sit-ins, marches, and other non-violent demonstrations demanding equal rights. Known for his powerful speeches, Lewis frequently reminded audiences that they needed to speak up and stand up for what is right. John Lewis, a quote, "When you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, say something, do something, get in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble." Close quote. John Lewis was born on February 21, 1940, outside of Troy, Alabama, the son of sharecroppers. He attended segregated public schools and said it was the activism and the radio broadcasts of Martin Luther King Jr. that inspired him to dedicate his life to civil rights. Lewis left Alabama for college in Tennessee, where he helped organize sit-ins at segregated lunch counters in Nashville. In 1961, he was one of the original Freedom Riders who challenged segregation at interstate bus terminals across the entire South. Lewis helped found the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committees and became a key ally of Martin Luther King Jr. At age 23, Lewis was the youngest speaker at the 1963 March on Washington, where King gave his famous "I Have a Dream" speech. John Lewis, quote, "We are tired. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We are tired of people being locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, 'Be patient.' How long can we be patient? We want our freedom, and we want it now." Close quote. In an interview with NewsHour's Gwen Ifill in 2013, Lewis reflected on his words that day. This from Gwen: "When you gave your speech that day, you were considered to be a radical. Everybody remembers the I Have a Dream speech as being this uplifting speech about togetherness and brotherhood, but yours was a little tougher." John Lewis, quote, "I felt that we had to be tough. I had to deliver a speech that reflected the feeling, the views of the young people, and also the views and feelings of the people that were struggling in the Black Belt of Alabama, in Southwest Georgia, in the Delta of Mississippi." Close quote. Lewis was selected as the was elected to the House of Representatives from the district that includes much of Atlanta in 1986, becoming only the second African American to represent Georgia in Congress since Reconstruction. Lewis continued to stand up and cause the good trouble he advocated throughout his life. Again, John Lewis, quote, "We're calling on the leadership of the House to bring common sense gun control legislation to the House floor." Close quote. He led a sit-in on the House floor in 2016 demanding gun control legislation after the Pulse nightclub mass killing in Orlando, Florida. He chose not to attend the inaugurations of President George W. Bush and Donald Trump. In 2011, President Barack Obama awarded Lewis the nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Today, Mr. Obama paid tribute to Lewis, writing, "He loved this country so much that he risked his life and his blood so that it might live up to its promise. And through the decades, he not only gave all of himself to the cause of freedom and justice, but he inspired generations that followed to try to live up to this example." John Lewis is an American icon, not just a Black American icon. He is an American icon. He started serving in the House of Representatives the year that I was born, and he died just last year. John Lewis will go down in history as one of the most prolific civil rights activists, leaders of our in the history of the United States of America. I call on the House of Representatives, the Congress, the Senate, and the president to pass the John Lewis voting rights legislation now. Don't wait. It's important. There is a movement among the right to disenfranchise millions of voters based on their poverty level, based on their color of their skin, based on whatever. In honor of John Lewis, we need to stand up and fight that with every ounce of vigor that we have. John Lewis is a hero of mine. The next person I want to highlight is an athlete. His name is Bill Russell. He's a legendary member of the most prolific Boston Celtics teams in the history of the NBA. I'm reading from an article in Slam magazine, Bill Russell's lifelong fight against racism. And this is written by Bill Russell. Oh, wow. Okay. A little more than 100 years ago, when my dad was born in Louisiana, there wasn't a school for black children to go to. So my grandfather got some people together to raise money to buy lumber to build a school, along with the $53 needed to hire a teacher for the year. They bought the lumber and then went to get the wagon and the mules to pick it up and take it to the building site. And the white guy at the lumber yard asked what they were going to do with all that lumber. One of the men told him they were going to build a schoolhouse, to which he replied, "Those kids don't need to know how to read to pick cotton." And he refused to give them the lumber, and further, he refused to give them their money back. Now, my grandfather wasn't going to accept that and said, "Well, if you aren't going to give us the lumber and you aren't going to give us our money back, then I suppose the third option is that I'm going to have to kill you." And he went to get his shotgun. Well, the guy at the lumberyard changed his mind pretty quickly after that and decided to go ahead and give him the lumber. Years later, in the early 40s, when I was 7 or 8 years old, my father drove us to the ice house to get some ice, and the white attendant ignored us while he visited with another white man. We waited for 20 minutes or so, and then the white man drove off. I thought the attendant would come serve us, as we were next in line, but another white man drove up, and the attendant went to serve him instead. My father started to drive off, but the attendant ran toward the car, and he shouted at my father, whom he had the audacity to call a boy. He said he better stay put or he'd shoot him. My father wasn't going to be spoken to or treated like that, and he calmly picked up the tire iron that was laying on the floor on the passenger side and got out of the car. The attendant turned and ran into the ice house as fast as he could. My father got back in the car, cool as he could be, like nothing had happened. What I learned from these events and many other events that I saw or experienced like these was twofold. First, that you must make the price of injustice too high to pay. Second, that such events are not reflective of your character, but the character of the perpetrator. I was also lucky enough to have parents who loved me. Their love was formative because I figured if they loved me, I must be worth loving. And as a result, I've never cared about being liked, only respected. It is their love that allowed me to set my own standard, to disentangle myself, my self-esteem, from the beliefs of others. This skill would prove invaluable throughout my life, and especially my career as a professional basketball player. I have long maintained that it is more important to understand than to be understood. What I understood was that in my junior year of college in 1955 at the University of San Francisco, my team went 28-1. We won the Final Four. I was a first-team All-American. I averaged 20 points and 20 rebounds and a lot of blocked shots, which they didn't count at that time, and was named the NCAA Tournament Most Outstanding Player. Yet at the Northern California Sports Banquet, they picked another player, a white center with less impressive set of accomplishments, as player of the year. I could have been hurt but rather, I simply dismissed that award. In December of 1956, already 2 months into the season because I was competing in the Olympics, I began my career as a Boston Celtic. The team had had a black player before me, Chuck Cooper, but when I arrived, I was the only black person on a team of white guys. Boston Celtics proved to be an organization of good people, from Walter Brown to Red Auerbach and to most of my teammates. I cannot say the same about the fans or the city. During games, people yelled hateful, indecent things. "Go back to Africa, you baboon, coon," and the N-word. I used their unkindness as energy to fuel me, to work myself into a rage I used to win. A few years later, we had a handful of black men on the team. There were still only about 15 black men playing in the league, so I complained about there being a quota, a cap, to how many black players could be on the team. That complaint led to change. The Celtics also ran a poll asking fans how they could increase attendance. More than 50% of the fans polled answered, "Have fewer black guys on the team." I refuse to let the fans' bigotry, evidence of their lack of character, harm me. As far as I was concerned, I played for the Boston Celtics, the institution, the Boston Celtics, my teammates. I did not play for the city or for the fans. Playing basketball during Jim Crow meant there were many times when bigots wouldn't serve us. In 1961, before we played an exhibition game in Lexington, Kentucky, some of my teammates and I were refused service because of the proprietor's bigotry. We walked out and boycotted the game, but such injustices took a toll. I'll never forget having to drive through the day and night to get to some place, ignoring the cries of my still young children, because there was no place to stop to eat or rest, no hotel or restaurant that would accept our blackness. None of my medals or championships could shield my children from white supremacy. All I could do was try to instill in them the love and pride my parents instilled in me and hope that it would be enough. In the 1960s, I tried to move to Wilmington, Massachusetts, but nobody would sell me a house. So I moved my family to Reading, a predominantly white town 16 miles north of Boston. Bigots broke into the house, spray painted the N-word on the walls, defecated in our bed. Police cars followed me often. I looked into buying a different house in a different neighborhood, but people in that neighborhood started to petition to persuade the seller not to sell to me. Around this time, Medgar Evers was murdered by the KKK. His brother Charlie asked me if I would do a series of integrated basketball clinics for children, which I did. I marched in Washington, supported Muhammad Ali. After that, the death threat started coming. I said then that I wasn't scared of the kind of men who came in the dark of night. The fact is, I've never found fear to be useful. Way back in 1942, when I was 9 years old, five guys ran by me while I was sitting on the steps outside the projects in West Oakland, where my family had just moved from Monroe, Louisiana. One of the guys slapped me. So I did what any 9-year-old would do, and I went and told my mother. My mother said, "They did what?" And grabbed me and grabbed the keys to the apartment, and we set out to find them. I didn't know what my mother was going to do exactly, but I was confident that she was going to take care of it. Eventually, we found the guys, and my mother turned to me and said, "Okay, now you're going to fight every one of these boys, all five of them, one at a time." I don't know what I was expecting her to do, but it surely wasn't that. I wasn't exactly scared of these boys, but I wasn't particularly eager to fight them. However, I knew better than to argue with my mother, so I fought. Many years later, people would talk about how I should have been a fighter, but I never really was good at it. That day was no different, and I lost 3 of the fights, but I won 2. On the way home, my mother told me that it didn't matter whether I won or lost those fights, but what mattered was that I stood up for myself. Maybe I lost my sense of fear when I fought those boys that day. Maybe fear isn't something a black kid in the projects could afford to pay attention to. My mother went on to tell me that I should never pick a fight with anyone, but that I should always finish the fight I was in. I'm 86 years old now, and I figure I've got another fight to finish. Yet another black man, George Floyd, has been added to the list of the thousands of black people killed by police brutality. Yet another life stolen by a country broken by prejudice and bigotry. When I was a kid, I learned to run away from the police because they'd arrest you, or kick you, or kill you if you were black. I remember when my brother Charlie started a little shoe shining business. He was 12 years old, and lots of kids shined shoes for money at the time. The police arrested Charlie, I think for not having a peddler's license, and I was struck by the unfairness of it. The white boys were never arrested for shining shoes, but the black boys were. My brother had a record because of it, and that record could be used later to show that he was a troublemaker and to excuse the behavior of a police officer who chose to abuse his or her authority. As an adult, the police would follow me around Boston, Reading, Mercer Island, Los Angeles. Early in the 1970s, I was pulled over by two cops while driving down Sunset Boulevard in a Lamborghini. I asked why they pulled me over. One of the officers said they had a report of a stolen car that looked like mine. I asked the officer exactly what kind of car was reported stolen. He looked almost panicked as his eyes rapidly searched my car, looking for a clue. He couldn't find one because the car only had a small emblem on the front of the hood. I again asked what kind of car was reported. Fumbling, the officer then told me that I looked like an armored car robber and told me to get out of the car. I raised my hands, both of them, as high as I could. One of the cops told me to put my hands down. I refused. Again, he asked me to put my hands down. A crowd formed on the sidewalk because it's difficult to ignore a very tall man standing with his arms straight up in the air. I refused. I said something like, "No, I'm not going to put my hands down because if I do, you'll say I went for a gun and shoot me." I wasn't wrong. I turned toward the crowd and yelled, "Don't shoot," as I began to very slowly reach for my wallet. I gently dropped the wallet on the car and shot my arm right back up in the sky. The officer again asked me to lower my hands and I refused again and shouted. It stopped the N-word in the expensive car time. The officers rifled through my wallet. Then the other officer asked, "Are you the same Bill Russell who played for the Celtics?" As the crowd began to murmur, the officer's tone shifted at the realization. They laughed and apologized. All of a sudden, it was a routine mistake. All of a sudden, I didn't look like a thief. All of a sudden, my blackness was excused. You don't need to tell me that racist police officers are a problem, and you don't need me to tell you that such racism is pervasive throughout not just police departments, but every American institution, because every American institution was built on the backs of black and brown people. I recently wrote an article for the Boston Globe referencing Strange Fruit, the song Billie Holiday made famous. This week, reports of black bodies hanging from trees have begun to surface. History must not repeat itself. But what can we do about it? Racism cannot just be shaken out of the fabric of society because, like dust from a rug, it dissipates into the air for a bit and then settles right back where it was, growing thicker with time. Police reform is a start, but it's not enough. We need to dismantle broken systems and start over. We need to make our voices heard through multiple organizations using many different tactics. We need to demand that America gets a new rug. In many ways, I owe my happiness to the love my parents gave me. Their love gave me confidence to simply be me. A proud black man, fair, and I believe dignified. Of course, as too many black and brown mothers will tell you, all the love in the world can't keep a black child from being murdered. More dust in the rug. Our children deserve better. All of them. Wow. Bill Russell is an icon. Bill Russell is possibly one of the most identifiable historic players in NBA history. Bill Russell stands over 7 feet tall. Bill Russell has Bill Russell has won more NBA championships than any player in history. Bill Russell is one of the top 10 or 5 NBA players, basketball players to ever play the game. But that did not stop Bill Russell from all of these horrific, overt, racist experiences. I just don't know what to say. I mean, I just how horrible. But what he says here, racism cannot just be shaken out of the fabric of society because, like dust from a rug, it dissipates into the air for a bit and then settles right back where it was, growing thicker with time. He goes on to say that America needs a new rug. I agree with Mr. Russell. America needs a new rug altogether. We cannot shake racism out of the fabric of society because, like dust from a rug, it dissipates into the air for a bit and then settles right back where it was, growing thicker with time. Wow, that's profound. Profound. Next person I want to talk about, another athlete, and he died very recently, within the last few weeks. This is an article from the Washington Post titled, Hank Aaron, Racism Carved Away a Piece of Hank Aaron's Heart. What Remained Was Still a Gift. This is by Jerry Brewer, a columnist with the Washington Post. It's not hyperbolic to consider Hank Aaron the perfect baseball player. It's not some grief-swelled attempt to lionize an irreplaceable giant. The man could do everything. Hit for average, hit for power, run, play flawless defense in right field, and lead. He could persist through racist hate and death threats and break the sport's most hallowed home run record. Aaron, who died Friday, this was written in January 23rd, after 86 years of quiet, dignified, and relentless living, was so great that he could have accessed the Hall of Fame without those 755 home runs. Take them all away, and he still would be left with 3,016 hits. And that's just the easiest way people illustrate his layered brilliance. He was a five-tool player who could have picked any single skill and made a lasting impact. Home runs don't fully capture him. He just happened to be so good at hitting them over such a long period of time. And he did it so well for so long. I should just read the article. That they became his most obvious on-field achievement. Celebrating Aaron is not a task that can be completed in a single solemn day. There were so many dimensions to him. So much substance and so little flash. And the sad part is that though he left this world as an icon, his route to reverence was so painful that he never felt all the love. And for as much as we admire Aaron, we never experienced all of him. There was always a wall created because of racism and fortified by Aaron himself out of self-preservation. It is a wall that many Black Americans, no matter how popular, no matter what age, put up just to survive. We have long considered Hank Aaron underrated. That says something about us, not him. He just went to work for 23 big league seasons, the last player to rise from the Negro Leagues to the majors. His career was a poetic bookend to Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier. As a teenager, Aaron went to hear Robinson speak in Mobile, Alabama, strengthening his desire to make it in baseball. He was committed, and from his debut at age 20, his determination was always on display, and it was often tested, especially when he challenged Babe Ruth's mark of 714 homers. We tend to label Aaron in a generic manner. We like to say he was an understated man of grace. Yes, he overflowed with grace. But like his game, it's important to look deeper. Behind that grace was restraint. On the inside, he was heartbroken, raging, skeptical. People threatened to kill him and terrorize his family, all because he was approaching Babe Ruth's record. He had risen from the Jim Crow South and became baseball royalty, only to realize it didn't matter how outstanding he performed or how classy he acted. He was still the enemy to some white people. and there were enough who thought this or tolerated it to drain joy from his signature feat. It really made me see for the first time a clear picture of what this country is about, Aaron told the New York Times in 1994, 20 years after he hit number 715. My kids had to live like they were in prison because of kidnap threats, and I had to live like a pig in a slaughter camp. I had to duck. I had to go out the back door of the ballparks. I had to have a police escort with me at all the times. I was getting threatening letters every single day. All of these things have put a bad taste in my mouth, and it won't go away. They carved a piece of my heart away. Imagine that. Think of your proudest moment, the culmination of your life's work, and then picture receiving thousands of letters expressing a desire to end your life because your greatness doesn't fit into their limited, bigoted view of the world. Of course, Aaron created a fortress. Few stars of his caliber have been so impenetrable. He was kind but closed during his playing days. Who could blame him? He was smart to be so protective, but Aaron being Aaron, there was another layer. Although it was difficult for many people to know him, Aaron offered enough of himself to inspire others and become an influential voice in challenging baseball to pursue greater equality. Despite his reservations, he took on the responsibility of being a great teller of baseball's story. Aaron could restrain even his pain and distrust, turning the struggle into something beneficial. He played the game in such a controlled manner. Willie Mays played with great flair, letting his hat fall off his head on purpose to emphasize his exceptional speed and turning what could have been routine plays into spectacular ones. Mickey Mantle enjoyed transcendent appeal. Aaron just kept playing his multifaceted game. He made a hard, vexing sport seem simple. He was durable and consistent. He aged impressively long before Tom Brady had his first bite of avocado ice cream. Aaron won his only MVP in 1957, but he finished in the top three six other times and was fifth once. He was an MVP at age 23 and still a top five player at 33. Then his power increased at 37 when he hit a career high 47 home runs, and he was still hitting 40 bombs at 39. That's the most effective way to deal with hatred, with continuous forward movement and an understanding that it's necessary to both prepare for the worst and remain adamant in pursuit of better. Barack Obama called Aaron one of the strongest people I've ever met. Of the racism he endured while chasing Ruth's record, the former president said in a statement, "Those letters changed Hank, but they did not stop him." Aaron protected himself, but he still had the heart to lead. Sports lost one of the greatest human beings it ever produced Friday. America, still resistant to sincere and everlasting change, lost a powerful and elegant repudiation of its evil. There were just two things that Henry Louis Aaron couldn't do: quit and relax. Thank heavens he was incapable of the former, and now in death he can do the latter. Which means it's on us to alleviate a pain that now outlasts him. Another icon in the sports world, Hank Aaron, possibly one of the best baseball players ever to play the game. He's known for his home run record that was technically beaten by Barry Bonds, though. Many people believe that there's an asterisk next to that because of the steroids that Barry Bonds used. Hank Aaron was a rare breed in an era where there wasn't many black baseball players at all, and there still isn't. Hank Aaron is an iconic baseball player, but like Bill Russell, there's so much more layers to him. So much that he endured during that time. Babe Ruth is held as the best baseball player ever to play the game, and to be pursuing his one of the most hallowed home run records in Major League history, the career home run record. Hank Aaron experienced something that no human should have to. It's because of those sacrifices. It's because of the way that he handled himself in the face of such great adversity and such great evil and hatred and hatefulness that people like LeBron James today can enjoy their greatness. People like Michael Jordan can enjoy their greatness because people like Bill Russell and Hank Aaron endured so much, so gracefully. Because if they were less men, Jackie Robinson and all of the rest of them that were great in this era and in the eras before modern superstars today, they wouldn't have the chances they have. If Hank Aaron, if Bill Russell, if Jackie Robinson would have, flown off the handle, would have become violent, would have handled the racism that they faced any other way, history would not look upon them the way they do. And players today of color would not have the same stature and the same clout that they have. People like Hank Aaron deserve so much praise. People like Hank Aaron deserve so much standing and status in not just the greatest athletes of all time, but people who inspire generations to be better, to love and to accept people for who they are, not what they look like. The equality that we must fight for. We have to look to people like Hank Aaron and receive that inspiration and that strength. Hank Aaron has always been an idol to me, and it's sad that he is no longer living, but he lived a full life, and I know that he is resting in paradise, inspiring a new generation of civil rights activists and athletes to use their platform to speak their truth, to stand up for justice and equality, and to do everything opposite of shut up and dribble. I'm proud to be a fan of these individuals. The only regret I have right now is that, I really wanted to highlight some lesser known heroes in America. And it's sad that to even be known as a Black American in this era, they had to do great, amazing, superhuman things athletically, and I think that speaks to how broken our system is, how broken the way we teach history, because outside of these well-known names, I don't know much, and I am taking it upon myself to learn about more lesser known heroes of the civil rights movement, of the abolition movement to free slaves, and I think we all need to do that. I think that we owe it to these pioneers to learn and to educate our children, to educate ourselves, because we need to keep moving forward. We need to keep moving forward. We need to stop taking steps backwards. And I am all in for my brothers and sisters of color. And Black History Month to me is a special month. It always has been. It always will be. And I hope that we can expand Black History Month to just not have a special month, but just to highlight their history, our history, our shared history throughout the year at all times, to truly link it all together. We owe it to them. When we come back, we'll wrap up with a very special individual, a non-athlete. You're listening to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor, special episode on Black History. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. I'm your host, Chris Taylor, and the last person that I want to highlight today in this special episode for Black History Month is an amazing woman by the name of Sojourner Truth. Sojourner Truth was born Isabella or Belle Bomfrey, in 1797, and she died in 1883. She was an American abolitionist and women's rights activist. Truth was born into slavery in Schuylkill, New York, but escaped with her infant daughter to freedom in 1826. After going to court to recover her son in 1828, she became the first Black woman to win such a case against a white man. She gave herself the name Sojourner Truth in 1843, after she became convinced that God had called her to leave the city and go into the countryside, testifying the hope that was in her. Her best-known speech was delivered extemporaneously, that means off the cuff, in 1851 at the Ohio's Women's Rights Convention in Akron, Ohio. The speech became widely known during the Civil War by the title, Ain't I a Woman? A variation of the original speech rewritten by someone else using a stereotypical Southern dialect, whereas Sojourner Truth was from New York and grew up speaking Dutch as her first language. During the Civil War, Truth helped recruit Black troops for the Union Army. After the war, she tried unsuccessfully to secure land grants from the federal government for former enslaved people, summarized as a promise of 40 acres and a mule. A memorial bust of Truth was unveiled in 2009 in Emancipation Hall in the U.S. Capitol's Visitor Center. She's the first African-American woman to have a statue in the Capitol building. In 2014, Truth was included in Smithsonian Magazine's list of the 100 most significant Americans of all time. Truth was one of 10 or 12 children born to James and Elizabeth Bomfrey. Colonel Hardenberg bought James and Elizabeth Bomfrey from slave traders and kept their family at his estate in a big hilly area called the Dutch name Schuylkill, just north of present-day Riften, in the town of Esopus, New York, 95 miles north of New York City. Charles Hardenberg inherited his father's estate and continued to enslave people as a part of the estate's property. When Charles Hardenberg died in 1806, 9-year-old Truth, known as Belle, was sold at an auction with a flock of sheep for $100 to John Neely near Kingston, New York. Until that time, Truth spoke only Dutch. She later described Neely as cruel and harsh, relating how he beat her daily and once even with a bundle of rods. In 1808, Neely sold her for $105 to tavern keeper Martinus Shriver of Port Ewan, New York, who owned her for 18 months. Shriver then sold Truth in 1810 to John Dumont of West Park, New York. John Dumont was a rapist, and considerable tension existed between Truth and Dumont's wife, Elizabeth Waring Dumont, who harassed her and made her life more difficult. Around 1815, Truth met and fell in love with an enslaved man named Robert from a neighboring farm. Robert's owner, Charles Catton Jr., a landscape painter, forbade their relationship. He did not want the people he enslaved to have children with people he was not enslaving, because he would not own the children. One day, Robert sneaked over to see Truth. When Catton and his son found him, they savagely beat Robert until Dumont finally intervened. Truth never saw Robert again after that day, and he died a few years later. The experience haunted Truth throughout her life. She eventually married an older enslaved man named Thomas. She bore 5 children. James, her firstborn, who died in childhood, Diana in 1815, the result of a rape by John Dumont, and Peter in 1821, Elizabeth in 1825, and Sophia in 1826, all born after she and Thomas united. In 1799, the state of New York began to legislate the abolition of slavery. Although the process of emancipating those people enslaved in New York was not complete until July 4, 1827, Dumont had promised to grant Truth her freedom from freedom a year before the state emancipation, if she would do well and be faithful. However, he changed his mind, claiming a hand injury had made her less productive. She was infuriated, but continued working, spinning 100 pounds of wool to satisfy her sense of obligation to him. Later in 1826, Truth escaped to freedom with her infant daughter, Sophia. She had to leave her other children behind because they were not legally freed in the emancipation order until they had served as bound servants into their 20s. She later said, "I did not run off, for I thought that wicked, but I walked off, believing that to be all right." She found her way to the home of Isaac and Maria Van Wagenen in New Paltz, who took her and her baby in. Isaac offered to buy her services for the remainder of the year, until the state's emancipation took effect, which Dumont accepted for $20. She lived there until the New York State Emancipation Act was approved a year later. Truth learned that her son Peter, then 5 years old, had been sold illegally by Dumont to an owner in Alabama. With the help of the Van Wegens, she took the issue to court, and in 1828, after months of legal proceedings, she got back her son, who had been abused by those who were enslaving him. Truth became one of the first black women to go to court against a white man and win the case. Truth had a life-changing religious experience during her stay with the Van Wagens and became a devout Christian. In 1829, she moved with her son Peter to New York City, where she worked as a housekeeper for Elijah Pearson, a Christian evangelist. While in New York, she befriended Mary Simpson, a grocer on John Street, who claimed she had once been enslaved by George Washington. They shared an interest in charity for the poor and became intimate friends. In 1832, she met Robert Matthews, also known as Prophet Matthias, and went to work for him as a housekeeper at the Matthias Kingdom Communal Colony. Elijah Pearson died, and Robert Matthews and Truth were accused of stealing from him and poisoning him. Both were acquitted of the murder. Though Matthews was convicted of lesser crimes, served time, and moved west. In 1839, Truth's son Peter took a job on a whaling ship called the Zone of the Nantucket. From 1840 to 1841, she received 3 letters from him, though in his third letter he told her he had sent 5. Peter said he also never received any of her letters. When the ship returned to port in 1842, Peter was not on board, and Truth never heard from him again. The year of 1843 was a turning point. She became a Methodist, and on June 1st, Pentecost Sunday, she changed her name to Sojourner Truth. She chose the name because she heard the Spirit of God calling on her to preach the truth. She told her friends, "The Spirit calls me, and I must go," and left to make her way traveling and preaching about the abolition of slavery. Taking along only a few possessions and a pillowcase, she traveled north, working her way up through the Connecticut River Valley towards Massachusetts. At that time, she began attending Millerite Adventist camp meetings. Millerites followed the teachings of William Miller of New York, who preached that Jesus would appear in 1843 or 1844, bringing about the end of the world. Many in the Millerite community greatly appreciated Truth's preaching and singing, and she drew large crowds when she spoke. Like many others disappointed when the anticipated second coming did not arrive, Truth distanced herself from the Millerite friends. In 1844, she joined the Northampton Association of Education and Industry in Florence, Massachusetts. Founded by abolitionists, the organization supported women's rights and religious tolerance. There were, in its 4.5-year history, a total of 240 members, though no more than 120 at any time. Truth lived and worked in the community and oversaw the laundry, supervising both men and women. While there, she met William Lloyd Garrison, Frederick Douglass, and David Ruggles. Encouraged by the community, Truth delivered her first anti-slavery speech that year. In 1846, the group disbanded and unable to support itself. In 1845, she joined the household of George Benson, the brother-in-law of William Lloyd Garrison. In 1849, she visited John Dumont before he moved west. Truth started dictating her memoirs to her friend Olive Gilbert in 1850, and in 1850, William Lloyd Garrison privately published her book, The Narrative of Sojourner Truth, a Northern Slave. That same year, she purchased a home in Florence for $300 and spoke at the first National Women's Rights Convention in Worcester, Massachusetts. In 1854, with proceeds from sales of the narrative, Cartes de Visite captioned, "I sell the shadow to support the substance." She paid off the mortgage held by her friend in the community, Samuel Hill. What she's most known for, and what I want to end on today, is her speech, "Ain't I a Woman?" In 1851, Truth joined George Thompson, an abolitionist and speaker, on a lecture tour through Central and Western New York. In May, she attended the Ohio Women's Rights Convention in Akron, Ohio, where she delivered her famous speech on women's rights, later known as "Ain't I a Woman?" Her speech demanded equal rights for all women as well as for all blacks. Advocating for women and African Americans was dangerous and challenging enough, but being one and doing so was far more difficult. The pressures and severity of her speech did not get to Truth, however. Truth took the stage with a demanding and composed presence. Audience members were baffled by the way she carried herself and were hesitant to believe that she was even a woman, prompting the name of her speech, "Ain't I a Woman?" In the original version of the speech was written about by Marius Robinson a month later in an issue of the Anti-Slavery Bugle. He writes, "One of the most unique and interesting speeches of the convention was made by Sojourner Truth, an emancipated slave. It is impossible to transfer it to paper or convey any adequate idea of the effect it produced upon the audience. Those only can appreciate it who saw her powerful form, her whole-souled, earnest gesture, and listened to her strong and truthful tones. She came forward to the platform and, addressing the president, said with great simplicity, 'May I say a few words?' Receiving an affirmative answer, she proceeded, quote, 'I want to say a few words about this matter. I am a woman's rights. I have as much muscle as any man and can do as much work as any man. I have plowed and reaped and husked and chopped and mowed, and can any man do more than that? I have heard much about the sexes being equal. I can carry as much as any man and can eat as much too, if I can get it. I am as strong as any man that is now. As for intellect, all I can say is, if a woman have a pint and a man a quart, why can't she have her little pint full? You need not be afraid to give us our rights, for fear we will take too much, for we can't take more than our pint will hold. The poor men seems to be on all confusion and don't know what to do. Why, children, if you have women's rights, give it to her and you will feel even better. You will have your own rights and they won't be so much trouble. I can't read, but I can hear. I have heard the Bible and have learned that Eve caused man to sin. Well, if a woman upset the world, do give her a chance to set it right side up again. The lady has spoken about Jesus, how he never spurned women from him, and she was right. When Lazarus died, Mary and Martha came to him with faith and love and besought him to raise their brother. And Jesus wept, and Lazarus came forth. And how came Jesus into the world? Through God who created him and the woman who bore him. Man, where was your part? But the women are coming up blessed by God, and a few of the men are coming up with them. But man is in a tight place. The poor slave is on him. Woman is coming on him. He is surely between a hawk and a buzzard. In the 1863 version by Gage, the speech was recalled 12 years after the fact. An activist in the women's rights and abolition movements, Gage, who presided at the meeting, described the event. The leaders of the movement trembled on seeing a tall, gaunt, black woman in a gray dress and white turban, surmounted with an uncouth sunbonnet, march deliberately into the church, walk with the air of a queen up to the aisle, and take her seat upon the pulpit steps. A buzz of disapprobation was heard all over the house, and there fell on the listening ear an abolition affair, women's rights. I told you so. Go it, darky, again and again. Timorous and trembling ones came to me and said with earnest, "Don't let her speak, Mrs. Gage. It will ruin us. Every newspaper in the land will have our cause mixed up with abolition and N-words, and we shall be utterly denounced." My only answer was, "Well, we shall see when the time comes." The second day the work waxed warm. Methodist, Baptist, Episcopal, Presbyterian, and Universalist minister came in to hear and discuss the resolutions presented. One claimed superior rights and privileges for man on the ground of superior intellect, another because of the manhood of Christ. If God had desired the equality of woman, he would have given some token of his will through the birth, life, and death of the Savior. Another gave us a theological view of the sin of our first mother, Eve. There were very few women in those days who dared to speak in the meeting, and the august teachers of the people who were seemingly getting the better of us, while the boys in the galleries and the sneers among the pews were hugely enjoying the discomfiture, as they supposed, of the strong-minded. Some of the tender-skinned friends were on the point of losing dignity, and the atmosphere betokened a storm. When slowly from her seat in the corner rose, soared Joyner Truth, who till now had scarcely lifted her head. "Don't let her speak," gasped half a dozen in my ear. She moved slowly and solemnly to the front, laid her bonnet at her feet, and turned her great speaking eyes to me. There was a hissing sound of disapprobation above and below. I rose and announced, "Sojourner Truth," and begged the audience to keep silent for a few moments. The tumult subsided at once, and every eye was fixed on this almost Amazon form, which stood nearly 6 feet high, head erect and eyes piercing the upper air like one in a dream. At her first word, there was a profound hush. She spoke in deep tones, which, though not loud, reached every ear in the house and away through the throng at the doors and the windows. After her speech, amid rows of applause, she returned to her corner, leaving more than one of us with steaming eyes and hearts beating with gratitude. She had taken us up in her strong arms and carried us safely over the slough of difficulty, turning the whole tide in our favor. I've never in my life seen anything like the magical influence that subdued the mobbish spirit of the day and turned the sneers and jeers of an excited crowd into notes of respect and admiration. Hundreds rushed up to shake hands with her and congratulate the glorious old mother and bid her Godspeed on her mission, testifying again concerning the wickedness of this people. My understanding of this incident or this event, when Sojourner Truth spoke, was she was carried by the Spirit of God, and it's said to be one of the most inspirational speeches ever given anywhere on earth in history. Sojourner Truth, everything that she went through, the way that she fought for women's rights and for abolition of slavery, She is one of those lesser known heroes that I enjoy thoroughly reading about. Ain't I a Woman is the speech. I wish there was video. I wish there was cameras at the time that could document that moment. Reading the speech, I could feel her soul. I could feel her power in the words that she spoke. Let us not forget her cause. Let us not forget the cause of women's rights. Let us not forget the cause of equality and justice for all, regardless of color of skin. Let us continue to move forward and not move backwards. I say this all the time, but at the very essence of the problem is a lack of love and compassion and empathy. If we have those things, racism cannot exist. If you have that hate in your heart, if you have that bias anywhere, even implicitly, do take steps to root it out. Question why you have those feelings. Admit when you have those biases. Admit that you don't know why you have them, but you want to take steps to eliminate them. Until we can be honest with ourselves, until we can talk about this openly and honestly and admit that systemic racism is a thing and that implicit bias is at the root of it, not overt racism. We harbor biases without even knowing it. And that is the harder racism to root out, because a lot of us won't even admit that it's happening. In this month, in Black History Month, and every month, we should highlight these heroes. We should highlight these stories. We should learn and we should teach our children. And that's exactly what I intend to do and what I am doing. Thank you for listening to this special episode of the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor. We'll be back next time. I hope you join us. Thank you so much. Have a great, great week. You're listening again to the Come This Far podcast with Chris Taylor.